My name's Harold Rhodes. I'm 73 years old, soon to be 74. I worked for the Rock Island Railroad from 1951 until it went into bankruptcy. I think in 1980, if I'm not mistaken. Then I went to work for the Missouri Pacific and retired off the Union Pacific in 12 years ago. My seniority date on the Rock Island was July the 5th, 1951. And of course, when you hire out on a railroad, go to work for a railroad, before they'll let you work, you've got to make student trips. I was hired out as a fireman at the time, and they still had steam engines. We had steam engines for probably a year and a half before they completely disappeared from the Rock Island. Rock Island had oil burners. They didn't have coal burners. They had oil burners. And starting out as a new person on a railroad, I think the best way to describe it is you're lost. You feel lost. And everything is just, you just don't understand what's going on, to be honest with you. And I can remember two of my student trips. The first one, I went out here on a passenger train to Boonville, Arkansas, with a friend of my dad's who was firing on the rocket. And just because I wanted somebody I knew when I got on this train. Coming back, we came back on a freight train. He wasn't with me. I didn't know the two people I were with, the engineer and the fireman. And I can remember somewhere between Little Rock and Boonville, the fireman went back and had three units, and he had to go back and check the engines to be sure they were operating properly. And he came up in a minute. He told the engineer, he said, "I need you to come back here and look at something wrong with one of the engines. I need you to come back here and look." And the engineer got up and left me in the cab of the engine by myself. Scared me to death. I didn't know what to do. I didn't do anything. I just sat there. But later on, I guess the next trip I made, I left here on a steam engine going to Jones Mill, Arkansas. They went to Jones Mill and switched the mill and came back to Little Rock. And as soon as we left here, the regular fireman put me in the fireman's seat and showed me where the firing valve was and how to handle the water and said, "Here, do it." That's how you learn on a railroad, to say, "Here, do it." And everything was pretty smooth. We got about 12, 15 miles south of town down here at a place called Vimy Ridge, and going around a curve, and we hit two torpedoes, which in itself scared me, because I never heard the sound. If you don't know what torpedoes are, they sound like shotguns going off. They're about the same amount of noise. And that scared me, and of course, the engineer, he reached up and he shut the throttle off completely, and I didn't shut the firing valve off and flooded the thing with oil, and black smoke came down the cab and everywhere else, and I thought we was dead. I really seriously thought we were dead. But finally, I made my student trips. You had to make, at the time, about four or five, which incidentally you did on your own. You paid for your own meals. You paid for anything else. Rock Island didn't give you any subsistence whatsoever. But I went to work. My seniority date was July the 5th, 1951. And my very first job was, they called me at about 3 o'clock in the morning to deadhead to Brinkley, Arkansas. They had a switcher at the time, and it was a steam engine down there that worked from Brinkley to Far City, Arkansas 3 days a week, and it worked to Stuttgart, Arkansas the other 2 days a week. So that deadheading was an omen, really. I spent a lot of time deadheading over the next 25, 30 years. But anyhow, I got along pretty good. Saturday, the last day I was down there, we had to go to Stuttgart, and we got over to Mesa, Arkansas, on the main line, which is where you branched off and go to Stuttgart, where the branch line ran down to Stuttgart. And here there was an old Rock Island dentist, Doc Montgomery. Never will forget him. He had one eye, kept looking at the other one, you know. And old Lyde Snyder was the engineer, and Lyde lets Doc Montgomery get up and run the engine, and me trying to fire it. And I was doing well, you know, with a good engineer, but we started down that branch, and that old man liked to wore me out. He'd open that throttle wide open, and he'd shut it off, and he'd open, he'd shut it off. And I was trying to keep up with that firing valve. He liked to wore me out before we got back in the run. But anyhow, some of the stories, talking about Stuttgart, I'll tell you a couple funny stories about Stuttgart. We had a switcher went to work down there. I think we would work 5:30 in the morning, so the crew didn't stay down there. We all stayed here in Little Rock, and usually had to get up about 3:30 in the morning, you know, and gather everybody up and drive down there and be ready to go to work. the superintendent went down there one day. They did have one conductor, Jimmy Roberts, that stayed there. So he went down to check the caboose one day and got up on a caboose. Jimmy had a pig. He built up a pig pen in the caboose. Mr. Harry wasn't really happy about that. Anyhow, one morning we left here, there was five of us, and the guy was driving, I sat in the front seat, and we had three men in the back seat. And we all looked like, you know, we looked like hell, if you pardon the expression. I mean, we never shaved, and you know, we just grungy looking. And you go down through England, and down then you hit the highway, goes to Stuttgart. And going through England, I noticed there's two or three state police cars, which is very unusual, you know. This was 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was really strange that they would be sitting like that. So we got down to where the road dead end, and you turn right to go to Stuttgart, and there was somebody standing there with a flashlight, and it stopped us. And it was a policeman, and he come over to the other side, to the driver's side, and he wanted to know who we were and where we were going and all this. And he, of course, you have to see this, but he had his hand up, and I thought that he had a radio to his ear. I really thought that. And he didn't say anything for a minute, and all of a sudden he said, he pointed and he said, "You three in the back, get out now and get your hands on your heads." Scared the hell out of me. I jumped out. But what this was up here was a shotgun. And they'd had three convicts escaping down at Cummins, and they were looking for them. And we looked like convicts, I guess.
Close enough.
But I don't know. I could tell you a couple of tales on me. Let's see, hustling there at Biddle a couple of times. I was out there working one day. It was on Sunday of all times. It wouldn't make any difference. Had to get an engine. We had a turntable. Had to get an engine out of the roundhouse. And people, I didn't think at the time. I thought about it ever later on. I never did forget it. But on the locomotive engine brakes, you can cut them out down the truck. And in the cab of the engine, it doesn't show the cutout. You still got air pressure and everything. So I hop up on this road switcher and gonna take it out there. And I got out about halfway on the turntable and went to set the brakes, and it just kept going. I put them in emergency with the emergency brake, kept going. Off it went to the end of the track. And they had to call a wreck rep to pick that sucker up. I went home. I never did say anything about that.
So you were off into the pit?
No, we didn't go. I didn't go into the pit. I did hit the turntable. I just went off the end of the turntable. But that was bad enough. It was wet and muddy, and that thing just sunk down. You know, I've seen them, and what happens when you go in? I never did put one in the pit, fortunately. But with a diesel, if you're going to go in a pit, what'll happen was when you get far enough, the front trucks will fall off of it, and it just falls down and stop. The whole engine won't go in the pit. Usually fuel tanks will hold it, you know. But then I was out there one day, and they had an old black man, and his name was Mink. That's what they called him. I don't know what his name was. And I bet you he was 85, and a good old man. A good old man to work with, but he couldn't do much. He couldn't get around much. He surely couldn't talk. I used to have to climb up on top of locomotives and sand them, that scared me. I didn't like heights myself, but he couldn't get up there, so I didn't. But I was out there one day, and I had a couple engines servicing them. And there's two diesels, and I cut them apart, and I pulled a pin between the engines and glanced around, looked back, and I hadn't set the brakes on this engine. And here it was going towards the turntable pit. So I dropped what I was doing and run after it and finally caught it just before it got to the pit and put it in emergency from the brake pipe. And I was really feeling proud of myself and looked around, here come that other engine. I forgot to set a brake. I run and caught it and set the brake on it, and I thought, man, wouldn't Mr. R. Rich was our road foreman. I said, boy, he'd really be proud of me if he'd seen this. But, you know.
That's how you got experience.
Yeah, right. Talking about Rich, I was, of course, this is before Betty and I got married, and you get a lot of times you get on. I was on the fireman's extra board, and you might go 2 or 3 days not work. I mean, that's just the way it works, you know. And so I came in off the job, marked up, not on the way. You know, I was 8, 10, 12 times out, something like that. No vacancies. So I went out honky tonking that night. You know, had a good time. Got up the next day and called out there, and still 8 or 10, 12 times out. Hell, I went out again. Next day I called, and the clerk said, "Mr. Rich won't see you." I said, why? She said, you've already missed two calls. I said, oh, my Lord. And I went out there and went in Rich's office. And you talk about dressing down. He was a good old man, but he was, they call it the R.R. Rich, Railroad Rich. I mean, I got to tell you a little story about him. After he retired, his wife was the sweetest woman you ever know. But she was never at home. I mean, literally, for years and years, he wasn't at home as much as I was. And he retired, and he was at home one day, and a washing machine or something broke down, and he was starting to fix it. And she said, you keep your hands off that, Raymond. Said, I've got somebody I pay to do that. But that's what you get. Railroad has a lot to do with that, being away from home so much. We were away from home a lot. I probably, when my kids were going up, I was away from home half the time, would you say, Betty?
Yeah.
I don't know, a lot of women deserve a lot of credit for raising children and a man being gone all the time, this and that and the other. She did a fair job.
We earned every bit of our railroad retirement. Because really, we should be getting a big chunk of it than the man.
Yeah, right. We had switch engine in Memphis, which were covered by engineers out of Little Rock. When they had a vacancy over there, somebody laid off, you called, got called off the extra board here, and you went to Memphis to work switch engine. Well, one morning I got called, no, I take it back, one afternoon I got called to go to take the wrecker to Havana, Arkansas. They'd had a derailment up there, and at that time, I think we worked 14 hours. I'm not too sure. It was either 12 or 14 hours. You know, one time we worked 16, and they gradually cut it down to 12. So we took the wrecker up there, and I'll tell you a funny thing happened up there. They turned over carbutane, a big one of them jumbo tanks, but it wasn't leaking. It was just laying there, you know, right close to the engine. And the assistant superintendent would come up there, and he'd about, I hate to say this, but he was about half loaded. But by the time the night was over, it was real cold, he'd sobered up. But anyhow, he kept running around there hollering, you know, be careful about that fire. And that we had a steam derrick, and be careful about that fire. When you went by that tank, be sure and put that fire out. We didn't want an explosion, this and that and the other. And that went on all night long. And early in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, I looked down in them section men, built a big fire right there next to that. But anyhow, our time ran out up there, and by that time they got the track clear, and a train came through, so we got on a train and came back to Little Rock, and came home and cleaned up and ate and went to bed. It was about 5:30, 6 o'clock. Of course, I'd been up all night long. I was worn out. So the next morning, I was called, for, I think it was 4 or 4:45, to go to Memphis on 26. So I got up and was in the bathroom shaving, and my wife, here come my wife. I mean, this is 2:30 in the morning. My wife don't get up at 2:30 in the morning. I'll guarantee you. Anyhow, she came in and says, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Memphis. She said, do you know they killed Martin Luther King over yesterday? And I said, no, it had happened after I'd gone to bed. And I said, no, I didn't. She said, well, why don't you lay off? And I said, that's why I'm going, because somebody else done laid off. They ain't going to let me off. So we went over there, and we put the train away, and went downtown. We stayed at a hotel down on Main Street, and went up and went to bed. And, oh, I don't know, about 3 o'clock, 3:30, the train master called me, and he said, would you mind getting up and coming on down here? Said, they're gonna stop all traffic on the streets at 5 o'clock. There will be no moving on the streets after 5 o'clock. I said, no, I don't mind. So I got up, and then the crew got up, and we ate, and we got the last cab that we could find. Ordinarily, they wouldn't let 6 of you in the cab, but they did with us. Anyhow, we got down there, and we sat around, waiting for them. We had to get a delivery from the Southern, and then before they get the train ready to leave. And so finally, the train master come in from the office with a shotgun. I said, what's that for? He said, I'm going to take you. We had to walk all the way to the other end of the yard to get on the engines. He said, I'm going to escort you down there. And they had killed a man there in the yards that day. Looting or something, I don't know what it was all about, but anyhow, we got down there and got on the engines. And what they did over at Memphis, it was a stub yard, and they built the train from the back end, and then we shoved the train out of the yard, because switch engine was on the back, but we shoved it out onto the main line. And we got ready to, well, we were backing out, and I looked back there about third engine back there, and there's two or three guys in civilian clothes. And I asked that train master, I said, who is that? And he said, that's Memphis police. They're going to be with you. You leave town. It was a little bit scary. I didn't feel like anything was going to happen to us as far as that goes. But I know they had a lot of problems, obviously, at that time. I went back over there a week later, worked with 359 switch engine, and I took my shotgun with me. And all the switchmen walked around there switching and had the gun strapped to their hips. And I had my shotgun on the engine. But like I said, I really didn't think anything was going to happen. But if it did, I wanted to be ready. Yeah. We worked west out here to Boonville, Arkansas. That was our terminal. And I had a guy worked out of Hartshorn into Boonville, and I cannot remember his name to save my soul, but he had a tendency to drink. And I was up there one day. There was two or three crews around here. We were standing around the depot talking, you know, and I wasn't going out. There was a train coming. I wasn't going to go out, or somebody else was, but I was standing there, and I said, where is he going to stop the train? He said, well, he's going to stop. There was a crossing about three blocks west of the depot, and ordinarily you stop up there, cut the engine off, come to the depot, get the crew, and then go back and get the train. And so I said, he's going to stop up there and cut the engines off. So here, we heard him coming. In a minute, I looked up, and I said, he ain't going to stop up there at that crossing. You can see that crossing up there. I mean, he was sailing. And everybody stepped back away from it. He come by that depot, I bet you if he was moving, he was going 30 miles an hour. And that brakeman was sitting back there just terror written all over his face. And he went off down there, finally got stopped by it. And just as soon as he got stopped, he put that sucker in reverse. And you could see the smoke just ball out of him old diesel. And he come back by there, and he went by the depot again.
in reverse.
Finally he got stopped, and he got the engine all cut off and come down there. He got off, I can't remember his name, but he was so drunk. He had a big old grip, you know, like railroad men do. And he tried three or four times to get through the depot door. He didn't have sense enough to put that grip in front of him. He kept trying to go through the hole. That was hilarious. But that engineer, good friend of mine, he passed away this year. And his name was Morgan Fowler. Hard-headed. I guess you might call him a typical railroad man, maybe, probably. But years ago, he lived off Roosevelt Road down here on Brown Street and had a two-story house. And so he decided he wanted to get his house painted. Benny Ross was a switchman, and he told Morgan, he said, you buy the paint. I'm going to tell you how long ago, you can tell how long ago this was. He said, you buy the paint, I'll paint your house for $50. Morgan said, like hell, said, I'm not paying you no $50 about it. I'll buy it, and I'll paint it myself. First day, he put that ladder up there and got about halfway off and fell off and broke his leg. It was all worked 3 months.
I'll tell you.
Had a job worked at Brinkley later on. You go down, it was Brentwood. You go down, the crew stayed here in Little Rock, but they drove to Brinkley, and they'd worked, and they'd drive back. And we were in a conductor. Here again, I hate to keep talking about people drinking, but anyhow, he was known to take a drink every once in a while. So we went down. Well, I ain't going to tell him. He had three or four brothers railroad. But anyhow, we were going down there one day, and I mean all the way down there. He preached. He was hot on the rules and living up the rules. You know, if you live up the rules, you're not going to get in trouble. And we listened to that. Takes about an hour to drive, frankly. Just before we got there, he said, hey, and I said, what? He said, anybody want a drink before we go to work? But I tell you, they were some sorry people. Now, I guess, like I said a while ago, in any industry, you're going to have them, but they do some things. We had a rule where you had it when you went in, came into a terminal, if it took you over 30 minutes to get back to the roundhouse, you got an hour's pay for it. And you wouldn't believe some of the things I've seen pulled to make that hour. We went into Boonville one day, and you had to go in the yard, which is a little unusual there. We took the train in the yard. The brakeman got off the line and derailed, so he'd go out the other end. He just went up there and sat down about 20 minutes, never made a move. And he took a derail off. We went back, and we made our hour. And one time, I tell you, this didn't have nothing to do with, this had to do with overtime. And a local went out here and went to Hot Springs. You tied up. And at that time, it was the latter part of the Rock Islands. The Missouri Pacific operated on Hot Springs, France, between Malvern and Hot Springs. Well, we got over to we left we got our orders at, I think we got some orders at Bauxite anyhow. We had enough time to go to Hot Springs for the hot, we had time on the local, Hot Spring on the Missouri Pacific local. We had time to go to Hot Springs. And I knew that and everybody else knew it. But we left Butterfield and got down in the woods where nobody could see you, and the conductor come on the radio and said, "That'll do." He said, "Stop." I said, "Okay." We sat there, I don't know, we must sit there 30, 40 minutes, you know, and finally he come on the radio and said, "We can go now." Well, we couldn't go to Hot Springs then. We had to go to Jones Mill. And as a result, we made 3 or 4 hours overtime. And we got to Hot Springs, and they come up there, and I knew, of course, everybody knew what was going on. I said, "What in the hell would you have done if a train master stepped on the back of that caboose?" He said, "I'll tell him we had a hot box."
Always something to say.
I'm going to tell you a funny story on me.
Okay.
Most of it's on me. After the Rock On, now you're aware of it, not some people may not be aware of it, but the Rock Island and the Union Pacific file with the Interstate Commerce Commission back in the 60s, I don't know when exactly, the deal was going to be the UP was going to take over the northern half of the Rock Island and the Southern Pacific was going to take over the southern half. Well, the ICC wallowed that around for 11 years. And finally they turned it down. By that time, the Rock Island had assumed that they were going to be taken over, and they had gone to what they called preventive medicine. Basically what it was is to keep you from falling off. It didn't work all that well, but to keep the track just good enough to hold a train, we could run a train on. And as a result, by the time the Rock Island was about to fold, actually, and the track was pretty bad between here and Perry, Arkansas, which is about 42 miles, it was 10 miles an hour. It took you 4 hours to go. And you try that about 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And so I left here one morning, and we didn't have firemen then, and I had a head brakeman, a good head brakeman. I don't think Robert ever shut his eyes. I don't know if he slept at home or not, but he didn't own a railroad. So we left here, and we finally got up to Perry, and the speed went up to 40 miles an hour. And going down through Perry, he went off hill and went down into Perry. They had a slow order, 10 mile an hour slow order. So I set the brakes, slow down. In a minute, I woke up. I'd gone to sleep. The train was sitting still. And I said, "What's wrong?" Robert says, "You got the brakes set in." He says, "You got the brakes set." I said, "Okay." So I kicked the brakes off, and we went over around Ola or Danville, one of them, had another slow order. I set the brakes, went to sleep. Woke up, the train stopped. I said, "What's wrong?" He says, "You got the brakes set." I don't remember who the conductor was, but I'll give him credit. He never said a word on the radio. So finally, got to Boonville, and I got off, and of course the other crew, outbound crew, got on, drug by, and the conductor got, first thing he did, come on, "What in the hell is going on up there?" I said, "I was going to sleep. That's what was going on." That sleeping was, back then, I was talking to somebody about this yesterday. Used to, you know, railroad, depending on where you were on the division, it happened here, most of your work was at night, road jobs. And they would get, to put it mildly, they'd get upset for sleeping on the job. Maybe that was good, that was bad in some cases, I don't know. Anyhow, nowadays, they recommend that if you're in a siding while you're on the train, they recommend you take a nap. Back then, they'd want to fire you. It kind of galls me, to be honest with you. But I don't know. So, of course, things have changed on the railroad.
They figured out some better ways.
Yeah, because you get called at midnight at 1 o'clock in the morning, and you go out in the yard, and you sit around there for an hour and a half, 2 hours, which is not unusual. And then you're up the rest of the night sometime till 9, 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. You're going to get sleepy. That's all there is to it. And you just have to fight it off to keep from going to sleep. They had a case, I wasn't involved in this, they had a case out in East Oklahoma. Can't even think of the name of that place now. This local went into siding out there waiting on a westbound freight train. And they all went to sleep. This is 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, whatever. They all went to sleep. Well, they all woke up at the same time, and they got talking about whether that train had gone by or not. So rather than go, of course, you know, if you'd gone to call a dispatcher and say, "Hey, we've been asleep out here," you'd have probably been better off. You might have been fired.
Can't do that.
Yeah, I know it. So they decided he'd left. And they took off, and they met him head on the first curve. I saw a picture of the a GP7, which is one of the earlier general purpose, bent in two, just like you take a tin can and bend it in two. I think there were a couple men killed. But that was bad, obviously. We were lucky around here. We had some bad derailments, but I don't remember anybody ever get killed in a derailment. Now, I was working over at Forest City one time we were doing a little work train work over, handling gravel and everything, and we were unloading gravel one thing and another. And we were about ready to get off and go home, and we had shoved everything up a hill over there, and the caboose was in front of the engine, and the brakeman was on the other end of the caboose. He was going to cut the caboose off, and we were going to go get in the car and go home. So he was all Charlie Graves was his name, and he didn't like railroad anyhow, but he had to make a living, so he railroaded. And he was all, when it come quitting time, he was always laughing, you know, and carrying on, just happy singing, you know. So we shoved those cars up that hill, and in a minute, I didn't see him. I saw him lean over, and in a minute, I heard him. And I thought, well, you know, Charlie back there, he's singing and everything like that. And finally, I told my fireman, I said, go back there, see what Charlie's hollering about. Well, he went back there, and when I shoved that rock up that hill, of course, the slack ran up the hill, and the drawbar on the caboose ran out. You know, it'll go out. And when I did, and Charlie should have known better, but he laid his hand on that yoke, and when that slack came back down that hill, his hand was in there. And I think, probably thinking about it, he was the least excited man on the crew. But we took him to the hospital at Forest City, and they couldn't do anything with him, and they asked him if he wanted to go to Memphis or come back to Little Rock. Well, his wife's a nurse at Baptist, so they brought him back to Little Rock. Of course, they had to amputate his hand. And I see him every once in a while. He got a hook, and he can do things with that hook. I can't do it with my hand, I believe. Well, I was local chairman for, I don't know how long, 18, 20 years, something like that. Anyhow, my first investigation, I had to call or represent a guy in a Rule G case on Rock Island. Rule G, if you were convicted, if you want to use a better, you probably have a better word than that, but anyhow, if you were found to be under the influence, you were fired for a year. It was automatic. And it was rude. You couldn't get a man back to work in less than a year. It's a lot of offenses. If you got 90, 100 days, you get back earlier, but not for Rule G. So I did the best I could. Of course, they fired him. And occasionally, when you were fired for Rule G, every once in a while, a special agent would call you and have you come out, and they'd sit down and talk to you about what you were doing, you know, and this year, not necessarily your personal life, but, you know, just how you were getting along. Well, this man had got fired. He called me one day, and I said, what's wrong? He said, they've called me, the special agent called me to come down there and say, for an interview. I said, well, fine. I said, go. I said, you don't need me. He said, yeah, I want you to go with me. I said, okay. So I said, you come get me. I was sick. In fact, I was sick in bed, to be honest with you. I remember that now. He drove up there, got out of that car out there, and his eye was glassy. You know what I'm talking about. I looked at him, I said, you're drunk. That's why you didn't want to go down there. He said, what am I going to do? I thought you were going to cry. I said, nothing. Go home and tell your wife to call him and tell him you got sick. And I straightened him up for a while. He came back to work later on, and, well, eventually when Rock Island went under, he went out to work out at Colorado Springs, I think, Missouri Pacific. And he's back here in Little Rock now. I saw him the other day. But they kind of frowned on drinking, and I can understand why. Oh, there was a lot of it going on, you know. But not to that extent, not the extent to where you didn't really, the guy gets drunk, he didn't know what he was doing. But, and that happened. We left here one day, we were working a job at Malvern, and went to work at, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, some ungodly hour, you know. It wasn't 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And we got out in the car down here, and we stopped at Malvern, stopped outside of Malvern, and went to a coffee shop. We all drank a cup of coffee, except one guy. He didn't go in with us. I don't thought much about it. So we got down there and went to work. We had to do some switching, then we were going to go to Camden and come back. That's what we were going to do. In a minute, the conductor came up there, and he said, you got to watch. I'm not going to tell you who he was, but anyway, you're going to have to watch him. I said, why? I said, he's drunk. I said, hell, he's not drunk. I said, man, I saw him get in the car at Little Rock. I talked to him. He's not drunk. He said, he's so drunk he can't hardly stand up. And while we were in that restaurant, he got drunk. He was one of them guys. Later on, I think he got fired permanently. We were on an engine one day, and he was on the engine, and a road foreman, this Rich I was telling you about, he was riding with us. And he asked the engineer, said Margaret, and Margaret Fowler, a friend of mine, said, you want a wrench of some kind? Margaret said, yeah, I got one in my grip there. Rich went to reach, and just before he stopped, he said, which grip is yours? Because the other guy was there. He didn't want to stick his hand his grip. He knew that much about it, you know. They pretty well knew what was going on, I guess. We had the Rock Island. I didn't have any problem with the Rock Island, except they were poor. Hell, I'm poor, you know. And it was really a big kind of a culture shock, if you want to call it that, to go to work for the Union Pacific. Because them people got money. I mean, they spend it, too. But the Rock Island, you know, we were down here, we were kind of a stepchild of the Rock Island, more or less. We were stuck off down here. Of course, the main line, you know, was north and south, from Houston to Chicago, and then out west through Kansas City and out that way. And actually, in my opinion, over the years, I think they've made a big mistake by allowing this Rock Island to go under, especially between Memphis, out of Memphis through here to the West Coast. Rock Island had the straightest railroad from Memphis to the West Coast, and they let it go under. We were going to, one time here, we went to the governor, when Clinton was governor, as a matter of fact, and was going to try to buy get enough money to rehabilitate the Rock Island, and the legislature turned us down. At that time, that's when interest rates were 18-20%, you know. And I think the guys on the Missouri Pacific and the Cotton Belt didn't help us a lot either. They didn't care whether we worked or not. Of course, a lot of us ended up. I say a lot of us. When the Rock Island went under, I was out of work about a year, I think. And of course, me at that age, that was in 80, 81, I couldn't do anything else but railroad. I could probably pump gas again. Yeah. And the younger, I felt sorry for a lot of the younger. Our house was paid for and our children were grown and I didn't have any bills as such. But a lot of the younger men, I felt sorry for them because they did. They had a big boat payment, a house payment, and car payment, and all that stuff. And a little bit of kid, they had to work. And a lot of them, as a result, had to leave Arkansas to go to work. Some of them went to work over there. Eventually, they hired 12 engine men over on Missouri Pacific. And I don't know how many trainmen ended up over there. Quite a few, I think. Of course, some of the car men and one thing and another. But it was a bad thing. And you wouldn't believe. I'll tell you a story again about myself. When we knew within reason that the Rock Island was going to fold, and you thought about it a lot. You knew you were going to lose your job. You wondered what you were going to do, and this and that and the other. And I got to the point, and I'm not exaggerating, I thought at times I was going to die. I really seriously thought I was going to die. And finally I went to the doctor, and he put me in the hospital and ran all kind of tests, on the man, I guess. He said, ain't nothing wrong with you. He said, you got arthritis, your neck and shoulders. But you'd be surprised at the men that had stomach trouble on the Rock Island.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Their livelihood was...
It was going out from under them.
Go out the door.
Yeah. And like I said, the Missouri Pacific crossed the river over there, but they couldn't hire everybody. They couldn't save everybody's jobs. They had guys scattered all around the country. Because like I said, they went to railroading because that's what they knew. The younger men probably could have learned another trade, but that's what they knew. And it was a good job, you know.
Yeah.
It's a good paying job. A lot of the problems, we hire a lot of younger men. Right after I got to be local chairman, and good men, I mean, I liked all of them, but they thought that the day they went to work for the railroad, they should have everything that I had, and I'd been there for 25 years, see. And I guess that's normal, maybe. They'd all go out and buy themselves a new car and a big boat and, you know, and a fine house and all that stuff. And the pay was good until they quit coming in. Then that kind of messed things up. Had a deal one time. We had a local went out of here to bauxite and back. And, of course, it wasn't a regular schedule. You ran extra, you know, you ran on your engine number. Well, they ran a crew out of here, and they had the wrong engine number on their orders, and they didn't catch it. So it wasn't no big deal, really, but there wasn't no other trains down there. But anyhow, they went down there and come back. Of course, the dispatcher caught him. And they called an investigation. And so they called the dispatcher out of El Reno had to come down, drive down from El Reno to be a witness, and then, but one of the crew members, the fireman, was sick. He wasn't going to be able to come to the investigation. So I went to the superintendent, Homer Dyer, and I liked Homer. Don't misunderstand me. He was really a guy, a nice guy to work with. I said, Homer, you can't hold that investigation. He said, why? He said, because Francisco's sick and he can't come. He said, I don't care. We'll hold anyhow. I said, okay. It's all right with me. So we got down. This dispatcher came with his representative, drove all the way from there. I felt really bad about it. And we sat down, and just as soon as we sat down, I got up and objected to the fact that Francisco wasn't there. We couldn't have that investigation if everybody on the crew wasn't there. And Homer jumped up, went in and called somebody on the telephone and came back and said, we'll have to postpone this investigation. I told that dispatcher, I said, I'm sorry about this. I told him about this a week ago. But anyhow, investigations, you find some funny stuff in investigations. Well, anyhow, I used to, years ago, it was not unusual for him to hire young men who are going to college and trying to get an education and hire them on the railroad in the summertime so they can have money to further their education. And so my brother, who is a pharmacy student, and he's a pharmacist, has been for years and years, wanted a job, came to me, wanted to know if I'd get him a job out there. So I went out, and Bill Honig was the assistant superintendent, and I went in and I said, you're going to hire some young men, you know, for one thing and another. How about giving my brother a job as a fireman? He said, what's the matter? Is he afraid to do a little work, afraid to get his hands dirty? And I said, no, he's not afraid to get his hands dirty. Well, we'll get him a job on the section. I said, I don't give it. Well, by then, I didn't care, you know. And so I just walked out. I got mad and walked off. Ended up, my brother went to work in Missouri Pacific that summer, worked as a fireman. But, you know, like I was telling you a minute ago, most of the officers that they've had down here, road foreman, and I dealt with road foreman more, you know, being an engine man, but an assistant superintendent when I was local chairman, and they were all, in my opinion, pretty good men. I know that the job and the men they had to deal with at time was a pain in the butt, and I think everything considered. I was talking about Dick Haley. We were out there one day, and I guess me and Stiver, we were sitting there behind the yard office, and the car department was behind us. We had our back to the car department, and they had derailed a car over, and they had the wrecker out picking the car up. And all of a sudden, that back door flew open, and Haley come by just hard. Kind of funny, going just hard as he could go. I said, what's wrong? He said, they turned the hook over. They'd race that car, get that car, and then put the outriggers out and turn that thing over. That was funny. A lot of funny things happened. He may not have thought it was funny, but I thought it was funny. Well, Dick Haley, he's a nice fella. You know, I'm not, but I hadn't been working here very long. And usually when you went to work as a fireman, before you could blink your eye, they had you over Memphis on a hostling job. They had a hostling job that nobody wanted. And so I went over there working a helping job, helping an officer. And went over in one day, and you had to go over to 4th Street where the yard was, where the trains left from. They had a 4th Street yard, which was the freight yard, and then they had a coach yard, which is down on the Mississippi River. And I took some ice over there, and I set it down on the scale. I didn't think anything about it. Here come Haley out. He said, God, he said, you can't believe that ice there. And I said, what? He said, it'll rust the scales. And I didn't know nothing about scales. I thought he knew what he was talking about. He knew what he was talking about. Later on, I found out, you know, it can't rust the damn scales.